There is a battle over free speech in our time. It seems that the left has a monopoly over the mainstream media, but also social media. What did the founders of America think about free speech? They even recognized free speech and a free press in the First Amendment. Bill Federer is a best-selling author and highly sought-after public speaker, and he's my good friend. Bill Federer joins us now on Vocal Point, and by the way, his website is AmericanMinute.com. Bill, always a pleasure.
Jerry, great to be with you.
Okay. So comment, if you would, about the whole issue of free speech. We live in an unprecedented time, you know, where we have the internet, we have all kinds of different channels that are out there. We don't have, you know, Walter Cronkite throning, you know, from on high saying, this is the news and this is the way it is and so forth. And, there's all kinds of different outlets. But is free speech somehow at risk in modern America?
Well, it definitely is. And the founders understood that free speech was necessary to a republic. If there's a king and you have an agenda, you have to get in to see the king to pitch your agenda. But in Athens, they didn't have a king, and it was the people. There were 6,000 citizens of Athens. And if you have an agenda, how do you do that? Well, that's when they invented theater, so they could have a way to portray their ideas and get everybody's attention. But they realized that they had to sway people, and so they developed something called rhetoric, and it's persuasive techniques in speaking. Ethos, logos, pathos. And ethos is the ethical reputation of the person doing the speaking. And that's come down to us as the introduction of a speaker. And, you know, you go to an event and you come in late and you hear somebody speaking and you're like, who's this person? But if you get there early and you hear the introduction, this is Dr. So-and-so and he's written so many books and he's been on television. All of a sudden, the introduction, you give more persuasive credence to what he's about to say based on the ethos. And then the second is logos. That's the logical argument presented. And then there's pathos, and it's the passionate appeal. And even Aristotle said no argument is successful, no logical argument is successful without an appeal to passion. And they say that, you know, in sales that there's an emotional component of every purchase. You know, why do they buy the blue car rather than the red car? You know, it's a non-definable emotional thing. So the it's persuading the public, and they realize this was important. In a country where the people are in charge. Now, I again put together a book called Socialism, and in there I go through the means to control what people hear. In the 1800s, you had Wells Fargo Wagon, Sears Catalog, and they would list everything about a sewing machine, and you would make an informed purchase. And then in the early 1900s, you had magazine ads, and a guy named Edward Bernays. And he realized that people would buy something without knowing anything about the product if they saw everybody else using it, the keeping up with the Joneses. And so this began to take marketing of a product, making it look like everybody's using it, to marketing of an ideology, to political viewpoints, by making it look like everybody is buying into it. And his work inspired Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister for Hitler. And he says, okay, if people do what they see everybody else doing, let's get 100,000 people in a big coliseum and have them start giving the Hitler salute in the front, and it'll work its way back in like a wave at a football game, and everybody else will see everybody else doing it, and they'll all feel pressured to give it, and they'll conform. And so Goebbels says, think of the press as a great keyboard that the government can play, and it's the absolute right of the government to manipulate the formation of public opinion. And so you get into the government wanting to control free speech because it knows that you think you're free, but you only can vote on what you know, and all that you know is what the media tells you. And if they can censor disagreeing voices and you think everybody's going along with something, you have this subconscious pressure to go along with it. Like little kids want to wear the same tennis shoes as everybody else. And, you know, ladies want to wear the same dresses and purses and shoes that looks like it's, you know, what everybody's wearing. And guys want to wear the tennis shoes and the jerseys of, you know, whoever looks like is winning the Super Bowl or whatever. And so there is in a democracy, the battle is over free speech. Who controls free speech? Who gets to have free speech? You know, I was going back in my research into Europe. Kings controlled free speech. If you spoke out publicly against the king, you were hung. It's called treason. It's called inciting rebellion. And so they even applied it to religion. That's when, even when you had the communists take over Colombia, what did they do? The first thing they did is go into the TV stations and take them over. They don't want alternative voices. The next thing they did is go into the pulpits and take them over. They don't want any pastors speaking out against them. They want to squelch. And so, but in Europe, you go through the king, even in England, where they passed a conventicle act in the 1660s, where it comes from the word covenant, where two or three gathered in my name. I'm there in the midst, and a lot of them in Scotland. And the king didn't like these small groups meeting, passing around their opinions and praying. And so if you had five or more people meeting in the home without the government approval, the FBI will bust into your house, arrest you, and drag you away to a room in the government building called the Star Chamber, because they had stars on the ceiling, and sort of like a January 6th hearing room. And they would twist your arm and brand you on the face as a heretic. And then they would stick you in a cell where you just waste away like for years. And so this was what happened to the early Baptists and Congregationalists and the Presbyterians. If they weren't going along with the Anglican king, they were put in the Newgate prison. And they couldn't share their opinions. So one of them was John Merton. He's considered one of the founders of the First Baptist Church in England. They put him in a cell, but they don't feed you in the British prison. You have to have some friend that misses you. And a friend brought him a bottle of milk, but instead of a cork, it had a wad of paper. And when the guard wasn't around, he pulled out the paper and unfolded it and took a splinter, dipped it in the milk, and wrote out his pamphlets. And when the milk dried, he folded up the paper, stuck it in the empty bottle. The guard takes it, his friend takes it home, and unfolds the paper and holds it just above a candle so the heat of the candle turns the milk brown. And they can see what he wrote, and they typeset, and they're printing these pamphlets. Then one of them that another Baptist wrote, Thomas Helwise, he says, "The king is a mortal man and not God. Therefore, he hath no power over the mortal soul of his subjects to place spiritual lords over them. The man's relationship to God is betwixt God and themselves. The king shall not answer for it." And if the king can stand there on the day of judgment, so to speak, believe whatever he tells you. But if he's not going to be there on the day of judgment, you're accountable to God for your own conscience. And kings didn't like that. And so you had these separatists, we call them pilgrims, fleeing to Holland and then fleeing to America. And so it was one of the primary reasons that you wanted to come to America, is that you would have the freedom to express your thoughts. There's a speech from Calvin Coolidge. He says that that congregations and their pastors came to America because they wanted the freedom to express these thoughts and put them into action. The idea that they could, you know, rule themselves without a king. And so the battle is over. And now it's media in the short run, but it's education in the long run. So just like they can spin a story, you can witness something, but then you go and you read the newspaper article and it's spun completely different than what you just saw, you know, at a meeting or whatever. They can spin current history, but they can spin history. And that's where you get George Orwell's book, 1984. And he has a character in there named Winston, who works for the government in the Ministry of Truth. But all he does is lie. And so he sits at his desk. And he wrote the book in 1948, and the pneumatic tube was a modern invention. If you go to a bank and you put your deposit in that little tube and it sucks it up, well, that was brand new technology in 1948. And so Winston sat at his desk and a pneumatic tube would come in and have the history that he was supposed to edit. And then he would take a little knife and cut out the old stuff. And the original history, he would put in another pneumatic tube that would suck it into an incinerator in the basement. And that was called down the memory hole. And you would have this continual and he said, every date has been changed. Every name has been altered. Every statue has been taken down. Every street has been, you know, renamed. And he says that the real history, even if I edited it myself, I don't know if anyone shares my memories. It only exists in my mind. And he says, the past was erased, the ratio was forgotten, the lie became truth. So if there is no God, there's no absolute right and wrong. What's wrong with lying about a story you witnessed today? And what's wrong about lying about history in the past? But it's this movement to not just squelch free speech now, but to twist it in the past. So, but the we're creatures that make decisions based on information. And so if they can control the information, I use a little domino effect. The people are controlled by, or the country is controlled by laws. Laws are controlled by politicians. Politicians are controlled by voters. Voters are controlled by public opinion. And public opinion is controlled by media, education, and now the internet. And to a certain extent, churches. Churches used to play a bigger role, but they still play a role of influencing. So whoever controls the media, whoever controls education, whoever controls the pulpit, whether it's scriptural or woke, right? And then the internet is now the way we communicate, whoever controls that. So that's where the battle is. It's over free speech. It's over who gets to share their views and share their information. The founding fathers, when they founded America, they realized that if they said something against the king, they would get killed. So they would write pamphlets and sign them with fake names. They'd publish it. So John Dickinson signed his articles from a Pennsylvania farmer. And Thomas Paine signed his articles, Common Sense. And Ben Franklin, it was Bonham Richard or Silence Do Good. Or, you know, and John Adams signed his articles, Novangelist, which means New Englander. And so they realized that if they put their real names on there, the police would be at their door. The FBI would come in and drag them away. And so they would write these things under pseudonyms, fake names. But once we became free from England, it's like, okay, we can speak in public. You don't have to hide your name.
And it shows you how radical, really, the First Amendment was. To acknowledge that we have these rights, God-given rights, including free speech and a free press. Bill, we have 2 minutes left. Whatever you want to say about free speech and the battle for free speech, have at it.
The gospel, the free speech to share the gospel. Most countries don't want you to share the gospel. Communist countries, socialist countries, and even dictatorships. Why? Because they say that you have rights from above the government's head, and they don't want you to have that view. So the gospel points forward to a future, a perfect world. And so in China, they don't want you looking forward to. So they outlaw the preaching of the Book of Revelation in China.
Oh, because they've already achieved the millennium in China, Red China.
Yeah, they outlawed the first two commandments. I'm the Lord, thy God, thou shalt know the gods before me. Thou shalt not worship idol, make any graven image, because they have images of their Mao, and they want the state to be supreme. And they've even gone in saying, okay, you're going to sing, you're going to have your singing part of the church service. Guess what? You're going to sing songs praising Mao or praising the communist dictator. But it's The freedom of speech is the freedom to share the gospel. And this
we have about 30 seconds left. But you know what? You can see this, Bill. It's because of Christianity that we have any of these freedoms. AmericanMinute.com. 30-second wrap-up on free speech.
Yeah, so the gospel is the most important thing. And the freedom to share the gospel is the second most. So I tell people, if you really believe the gospel is the answer, you're going to be involved wanting to preserve the freedom to speak the gospel. And if you're not out there getting involved to preserve these freedoms, you really don't believe the gospel is the answer.
Excellent point. AmericanMinute.com, Bill Federer. Thanks, Bill. All the best.
Thank you, Jerry.